So a TIN, a citizen cannot get a TIN, but I find all these people, you know, like these trust promoters and everybody else, employer identification numbers, you know, without looking at any forms, they want you to get on the internet and, you know, don't look at any form, you know, use some IRS portal to get an EIN or something else like that. Avoid even looking at any applications, and people will come along and get EINs and stuff like that without ever having seen the applications for them, which can be very revealing.
Now, Larry, do you think that it'd be worth making an argument about, or is it just something for everybody to have general knowledge and understanding?
I think something for people to be not, you know, when you're trying to figure out how the tax laws apply, you know, there are little areas, little subject matters that, you know, when you exhaust one particular subject matter, it leads to this conclusion. And then when you look into some other subject matter, you exhaust that subject matter, it leads to certain conclusions. So when you have a number of these conclusions you reach when you, you know, when you're dealing with several areas and they all lead to one conclusion, you know, that then the conclusion you ultimately reach means something.
And it should go without saying, but what we've been showing you the entire time is IRS literature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's really, I think it's just tradition that has kind of kept us from, you know, just being able just to absorb the breadth of the entire tax system. Because, you know, when they use this wonderful language like individual, you know, individual taxpayer, a citizen who's an individual who's a citizen, individual who's a resident, you know, a non-resident alien individual, that word individual, you know, Larry mentioned it last week, you know, if we could really just kind of just encapsulate and do a complete understanding of the word individual and how it fits into the Internal Revenue Code, I think we'd be a lot closer to figuring out who is subject to the tax, frankly. And we'll probably sooner or later get there too. But on this W-7, you can see, like Larry said, there it is, says for use by individuals who are not U.S. citizens. So a citizen cannot have a taxpayer identification number, but that's what they're asking for on a W-9, and then they slip it in Social Security number. You know, and I believe that the taxpayer identification number language should not be anywhere on that form W-9. And then, of course, the proof of that is, scroll down to part two of this W-9. It says certification. Under the penalties of perjury, I certify that the number shown on this form is my correct taxpayer identification number. Isn't that kind of silly? Or I'm waiting for a number to be issued. And two, I am not subject to backup withholding because A, I am exempt from backup withholding, or B, I have not been notified by the Internal Revenue Service that I am subject to backup withholding as a result of failure to report all interest or dividends, or C, the IRS has notified me that I am no longer subject to backup withholding. And finally, I am a U.S. citizen or other U.S. person defined below. And if you go to the definition of U.S. person down underneath the date signature box, and what they've done, in my personal opinion, is they've confused the definition of a United States person with an individual who is a U.S. person, which is a different definition altogether. They're defining a qualified individual, in my opinion, when they say an individual who is a U.S. citizen, a resident alien. That would be section 911 D1A and D1B. Actually, it'd be D1B, folks. 911 D1B. Little d in parentheses, one in parentheses, and a capital B in parentheses, D, and then dog, one, B. So this definition of a U.S. person is skewed at best, but it says it enough that you're a citizen. And they're saying an individual who is a U.S. citizen or resident alien, to me, is a warning flag. But nonetheless, they've married two definitions into one in this definition of a United States person. Sign under penalties of perjury, give it to the requester. And Mark is asking, is there a form W-7 that is for individuals? That would be a W-4, actually. Never mind. No, I think this is it. W-9 is your, this is your ticket to being either an exempt recipient or someone who is subject to the tax. And is there any other documents that we talked about, Joe?
No, I think that's it. I was curious, as far as that change in 2011, or 2011 being the last year when they had it set up that way. Exactly. You or Larry, as far as what, I mean, we know the IRS plays games with this stuff, and they'll play games with what we talk about tonight, right? Because they'll we'll clue them into additional ways that they're telegraphing the truth. So, we've got to obscure the truth some more. You know, they're on to us again. But my question is, with that change to the form, and basically in the 2000, well, those later forms, basically not accommodating certain situations, like especially the probably the most prevalent one, that you're an exempt payee, or it doesn't cover you. I mean, that to me just seems like what's the process again about how they change forms? And in other words, would there be any way to drill down on the paper trail that shows why they requested that change and what excuses they made for the request for change? You see where I'm going with that?
I do. There's two regulations. There's don't hold me to it, but I think it's 31.3406G-3, and then there's 31.3406H-1 regulations. So if you write that down roughly, Joshua says there's no OMB number. That is correct because you don't give it to the IRS. But back on the topic of this, the whole scope of a W-9, under those regulations, the 31.3406G-1 and 31.3406H-3 discussing a W-9, you can actually make your own W-9 as long as it has the same basic information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like a substitute, like they would talk about a substitute 1099.
And as long as you sign under, say that you're a citizen and sign under penalties of perjury, I don't think that the requester could reject it.
I see. Yeah, because if the newer form does not accommodate your circumstances, seems like a no-brainer. And then you're basically saying that there's regs that justify using a completely ginned up form that covers all the bases, or an older version that covers the bases. Is that basically what you're saying?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the last year for the W-9 in any kind of form that's recognizable to the original intent of it is the 2011. You know, you can probably go back to the very first year they were requested. But
and another question I have, hopefully I'm reading the minds of some of the audience, but so in trying to understand the purpose for the W-9, maybe, I mean, from the standpoint of the IRS as the agency that's, you know, administering and enforcing these laws, am I understanding that this form is really geared towards the foreigner, it to be just in a, you know, a generic sense. It's geared towards the foreigner, hence it's asking for a taxpayer identification number that can't be applied for by a citizen. And so the number three below, where it's, you're declaring I'm a citizen, it's almost like saying, okay, you gave me this form. This form is for foreigners. I'm not a foreigner. Is it kind of serve a dual purpose of telling them I'm not a foreigner and that I am a U.S. citizen?
Well, if you want to just kind of get off the fairway and into the weeds, the way that I understand how they use U.S. citizen, and this is critical, a U.S. citizen, based on research as well as documentation in the Internal Revenue Manual, a U.S. citizen is a naturalized citizen, a foreigner who became a resident alien and then passed the citizenship test and became a U.S. citizen. Because you can see it says, I'm a U.S. citizen or other U.S. person. Well, a U.S. person would mean and include a U.S. citizen. But a U.S. person is a citizen of the United States. And more specifically, a citizen or resident of the United States, a resident alien.
I see.
And I've had people argue with me and take issue with the fact that I'm comfortable being a U.S. person, and they don't believe that they're a U.S. person. And you know, I have a friend who thinks he's a non-resident, non-person. So I can hear somebody chuckling on in the group, but the purpose of this form is just simply say I'm a United States person. And I would say that if you wanted to make your own form up, include the definition of a United States person at 7701A30, and it'd be more apt and more correct than their definition of a U.S. person, which is mixing Section 911 and Section 7701A30 together. It may sound confusing to you, but it's true.
Very good. Those are all the forms that we talked about showing prior to the show, unless there's any of these regs or anything that you wanted me to illustrate. Larry, did you have any comments about what we've been talking about here?
Am I on? Ah, now, ma'am. I turned myself off. You know, Gary, you were looking at the form talking about citizens residing abroad. You know, just looking at the titles of some of these instruction manuals, instruction booklets
that
you've been reviewing, you know, there isn't one out there for a citizen at home, is there?
No, that's an interesting point, isn't it?
So in reference to topics, you know, when they're honing in on a citizen specifically, the manual that you can find that the IRS publishes, which deals with citizens, is going to be a citizen residing abroad.
That's publication 54.
Hey, Joe, you know, I emailed to you thinking that we were going to be getting into this, but I sent to you an instruction booklet for a Form 1040 for 2010 that I emailed to you earlier, you know,
but yes. And I do have it. Okay. Let's see here.
Yeah, but this is something new, you know, we talked about years and years ago, but you know, 2010 is real good for this part of the instruction manual. So when you go down to income, you've got the 2018 Pub 54 on there, and I was wanting to get the 2010 1040 instruction booklet up on the screen.
I mean, I have the Pub 17, but I can get the instruction.
Well, no, I emailed you the instruction booklet for the Form 1040 for 2010 when we started the program. I'm thinking that we were going to be getting into that topic. So I emailed it to you already.
Well, yeah, that must have been so close to the beginning of the show that I don't have that. But let me put up the income.
Yeah.
One.
This is something we've talked about, but there's some new people on this that, you know, how things can be revealing with some of these instruction manuals published by the IRS. So which one are you pulling up, Joe?
I'm trying to get to this income one, but I've got so much stuff going on my screen, I can't seem to.
Well, Gary does the same thing. He has 50 files open at one time.
I resemble that remark.
Let's see if I close a couple, see if that helps me.
So, you know, the instruction booklet for each year, you know, they'll discuss each line. And then you'll get down to a line where they're talking about income. So the manuals, the instruction booklets for the Form 1040, you know, as they go through their discussion of line by line by line, you soon get down to, what is it, line 12, you know, income. And in the old manuals, you know, I've got personally on my hard drive, you know, I've got the instructions, the forms and the instructions for the 1040 and other forms all the way back to 1913.
Larry?
Yes, Gary.
Cassandra asked a question regarding the ITIN, and, you know, she's you'll notice her chat.
Okay, hey, listen, Joe's got, no, but see, the 2018's not going to do it, Joe, because it, you know, they made a change, you know, they saw their mistake, but go back to the 2010.
Okay.
Well, while, you know, I've already looked at 2018, you know, the 2010 is, you know, and more years before that, but I emailed it to you, Joe. It should be in your email. Yeah.
This the one? Okay.
Yeah. I go down to, you know, this is, you talked about this 20 years ago, Joe. I go down to, you know, I don't know, it's about page 7, 8, 10, whatever. Keep on going down. Doug Shulman. Keep on going down. Okay, we keep on going down until we get to income, maybe the next page.
Yeah, I think I'm on it there. It's just maybe taking a while for you.
Yeah, right there. Okay, income. And look how they just start off. Foreign source income. You just kind of a, you know, they used to be real obvious like that, but in more recent years, they've kind of had a little bit of explanation before they put something before foreign source income. But, you know, but here in the 2010 instruction book, you know, when they're talking about income, the first thing they talk about is foreign source income.
Yeah. And then they refer you to publication 54.
Yeah.
Why don't they just?
Oh, and you better use that form 2555 too.
Yeah.
See everybody, how we? I mean, we chuckle. Not it's kind of a gallows humor because it's just, it's plain as day. But of course, plainer. It gets plainer the more you look at this, and of course, that's why we're trying to have these shows and share the reason for our chuckling, because. The IRS admits it, you know, but if you actually repeat what they admit, if you point out what they admit, they tell you, you know, you're a conspiracy theorist and you don't want to pay your fair share and you're reading it wrong.
Well, it reminds me of a guy I used to play golf with, and I've said this more than once. He said, "I'll never lie to you, but you better listen very carefully." And I said, "I believe that's what the IRS is telling us." You know, right there, income, foreign source wealth. That, I don't have any foreign source income, so it really didn't matter. You know, people would just kind of just skate over that instead of going, what does that mean? Well, where does it have U.S. source income in this book? Oh, when they're talking about a foreign person. Pardon me.
That's exactly right. So, Larry, I think I can get you the income document. So that should come.
Well, this is what I was talking about, Joe. You got it on the screen. Now you can. Now that you've shown to our attendees, that's something different. Well, I thought that there were some people last week that were inquiring about. Well, you know, gee, what we were talking about in reference to income, you know. The role of the old statutory definitions of gross income. And so I just emailed to both of you. And if somebody wants to have it emailed from y'all to them, you know, you need to tell them how to do it. You know, but this is a good explanation of what we've been talking about in previous programs, previous shows.
And is this available on your website as well? Or
no, well, not in this fashion, no, but. You know, for this specific point, you know, this relates to going back to the old statutory definition of gross income, you know, gains, profits, and income derived from wages, salaries, and compensation for personal services, which the Supreme Court says is the maximum reach of Congress's power to tax incomes under the 16th Amendment. Well, you know, just that Section 22 definition shows that income and wages are different. You know, you follow your rules of statutory construction. You know, each word has its own specific meaning. Each word is different from the words surrounding it. So, you know, for that argument that we have talked about in previous shows, this little document, what is it, 6 or 7 or 8 pages long? You know, I was just thinking that either one of you, for our listeners, you know, you've given out your email, you can send it to them.
Yeah.
Hey, Larry.
Yes.
Just to add some clarity to your comment about like wages and salaries. Give the audience, give our friends, the difference between what a salary is as opposed to what wages would be.
Well, you know, here we have on the screen, you know, the old Section 22 definition of statutory definition of gross income. It includes the subject of the tax is gains, profits, and income. Now, using rules of statutory construction, each of those words is a little bit different from the other. But then, you know, you can also see that salaries, wages, and compensation for personal services is entirely separate, apart, and different from gains, profits, and income. And in fact, income is derived from salaries, wages, and compensation for personal services. But then again, what are salaries? You know, well, commonly people think of salaries as a payment for work performed on the basis of a week, month, or a year.
Oh,
and okay. Wages are a payment for work done by the hour. But then, you know, salaries and wages then seems to encompass most what everybody in this country makes. Well, but the salaries and wages are something different from compensation for personal services. And then, you know, you'll see if you move forward into time, you know, Section 22 became Section 61 under the current Internal Revenue Code.
Yes, sir.
And, you know, whereas previously you could see in the statutory definition, salaries and wages, you know, salaries and wages is not under Section 61. And you start off with compensation for personal services or compensation for services. And that under the old law was different from a salaries and wages. You know, so you have this real unique problem. Why in the world has salaries and wages been dropped from the Section 61 definition? But then, you know, with the material that I've got posted on my website, which includes all the old tax acts and all the old tax regulations, you know, once you understand the pattern of the tax laws as well as the regs, and since they're all word searchable, it makes all the sense in the world, at least to me, that, you know, our students, you know, take one point and you just kind of follow it through. It's not difficult for you to take the tax acts and isolate. And in fact, I've done it over on my website. Well, where are all these statutory definitions of gross income? Well, you know, you can find them. They're just one section in each of the old tax acts. Well, then once you understand the regulations are kind of explaining these terms and the tax laws a little bit more fully, then, you know, you'll find that, you know, just like you can follow gross income through all the old tax acts, you can follow, the definitions and the regulations for these very same terms. And, you know, just doing that, you know, is very educational. You learn a lot just by starting off with, you know, like down here on the bottom of the screen, the commissioner defined compensation for personal services, you know, here in 1918. And then for Regulation 62 for the Revenue Act of 1921 and Reg 65 for the 24 Act. You know, here's this definition of compensation for personal services, which is on the screen. Now, you got to remember, the commissioner was confronted with, you know, this complex law. Well, he had to have everybody in the Bureau of Internal Revenue on the same sheet of music. You couldn't have, you know, two guys in the same office having different views about what something meant. No, they come out with all these regulations, and this is what it means for everybody. Everybody in the IRS has got to toe the line. They've got to say, hey, you know, for a particular problem, you know, we're going to turn to and use, you know, the currently existing regulations. So a set of regulations was just nothing more than the a greater expansion of the income tax laws meant, according to the Commissioner of Internal Revenue and the Secretary of the Treasury. They explained it in greater details. And the people that work for the Treasury Department and the Bureau of Internal Revenue, they were bound by the regulations. So the regulations mean something. So you can follow it forward. And you can follow it starting like I've got up here, but you can follow it through all the later regulations. And of course, all those regulations you can download off of my website, or you can get them from Joe's CD. You know, Joe will. You know, I think the CD is very beneficial for people. I think people ought to get the CD from Joe. And then, you know, hey, when you're dealing with the IRS, burn a copy of that CD and send it to them. Hey, they don't have, you'll show to them that they will no longer have the excuse that they can't dig up this old stuff. But why? Because you gave it to them. You gave them the old tax acts and you gave them all the old tax regulations. But you can follow it forward into time, you know, like compensation for services, which is a separate independent little study on your own. And if you do that, you'll learn a lot, especially if you trace it into the current law, current regulations. And boy, there's some real zingers and real interesting definitions of compensation for services in the current regulations. And, you know, as you and I have said, Gary, boy, we agree with the commissioner.
Oh, the commissioner. Long.
Yeah. I mean, he's.
That's a federal offense.
Yeah.
To agree with the commissioner.
No, but it's the people that work for him that don't agree with him.
Right. And I think he tells them indirectly, don't agree with me. But don't look and see what I've said on the topic.
Yeah, use your own wild ideas.
Right.
That's the reason why we had regulations to begin with, to do away with your own personal views about what the tax laws meant. There had to be the departmental view of what the tax laws meant.